dear viewers of the Soul Chaser Becky YouTube channel, and welcome to episode 9 of Valhalla Conversations, titled Worthy Women of Saga and Mythology and Legends and everything else in between. And this episode is a very special episode because I'm not on my own as a woman. I've got two other excellent women guests joining me today, and they themselves are the hosts of a really good YouTube podcast, and it's also on Spotify and all the other places you can find good podcasts, called Shield Maiden Women of the Norse World, which is appropriate because that is what we're going to be talking about tonight. So ladies, if you'd like to introduce yourselves, who would like to go first?
Kim,
would you like to go?
Sure. I'm K.S. Barton, and I'm the author of the Norse Family Trilogy, in which a young Viking woman and a Viking warrior are caught in a deadly blood feud between two brothers. And here's the first book. It's called Warrior and Weaver.
Beautiful.
She's the weaver, he's the warrior. But you know, even if she's not fighting with a sword and a shield, she's still pretty fierce.
That sounds fab, and it is on my to read list. I've got it on my Kindle. I just need to find time to read it. Like all my other books, I need to find time to read them.
I hear you.
Okay, well, thank you for joining me tonight, Kim. Well, tonight
thank
my time,
afternoon me.
Your time. Time zones, everyone. We need to find the Doctor Who TARDIS to all meet in the same spot. Okay, and who else have we tonight?
I'm Johanna Wittenberg, and I'm the author of the Norse Women series, which is the story. This is my hardback that I just got recently. Mm-hmm. At this point, I'm up to 6 books. It's the story of a real Norse queen who lived and ruled alone in early Viking Age Norway. And I'll be talking about her later on in the podcast. So nice to see you both. And thank you for having me, Rebecca.
You're very welcome. Thank you for agreeing to participate in what is effectively my joyride of pursuing my passion for anything Viking-y and going where it goes. And thankfully, having wonderful guests like you let me vent out that passion and follow it to wherever it may end. Okay, so for tonight's topic, dear viewers and listeners, we have each picked a woman from the sagas or history and a woman figure from the mythology and legends. And so we've each got kind of a favourite, kind of a female champion, but there's so many out there. There really are so many. And I shall begin. So mine is a woman that probably many may not have heard of, when I can get my words right, called Ord the Deep-Minded, or she'd sometimes go by the name of Unra or Unna. I can't get the Icelandic pronunciation right. But she has been written about in various books about women in the Viking Age. And so I'm not going to talk about it. I'm going to read from the book because they've written it a lot better than I can explain it. And I'm going to start off with Women in the Viking Age, which of course which is a very good book to break into for those who have an interest in women in the Viking Age, both historically and mythologically. And of course, it's written by the wonderful Judith Jesch, who I've met many times, many years ago, albeit at the University of Nottingham when I used to go to the Midlands Viking Symposium there annually. So, to begin. According to the Landnámabók, which was the big tomb of sagas of Iceland, Ordr was the daughter of the Norwegian chieftain Ketil Flatnose, loved the Norse nicknames, who went to the Hebrides as an agent for King Harald Finehair. She married a Norse king of Dublin, not every woman can do that, who was sadly killed then in a battle in Ireland. Her son Thorstein was then killed fighting in Scotland. And so Ordr's two main projects were then to leave for Iceland and to marry off Thorstein's many daughters. She prepared a ship in secret, which is pretty amazing, and 20 free men accompanied her. So again, men follow the woman. Not often you can counter that. She married off a granddaughter each in Orkneys and the Faroes and arrived in Iceland, where two of her brothers were already living. Her retinue was so large that the first brother could only felt able to invite half of them to stay. Offended, Ordr went then to stay with her other brother, who was obviously more obliging. The following spring, she went to look for a place to settle, and in Breidafjordr, and a number of the place names of the area are explained by little anecdotes to do with her. such as Cam's Nest or Comb Headland, is so called because apparently she lost her comb there. So if anyone finds a comb there, it could be hers. Ordo chose to live at Havermore, where she raised a cross, because she was a good Christian, although her descendants later relapsed. Interesting. In this district, she distributed land to her shipmates and freed slaves, and the remaining granddaughters were married. Finally, we are given a detailed description of her death. She invited all her relatives to a magnificent feast, and after 3 nights, she gave everyone gifts and good advice, saying the feast should continue another 3 nights so that it could be her funeral feast. She then died rather promptly and conveniently and was buried on the seashore, as she had not wanted to be buried in this unconsecrated earth. However much we choose to believe, it is clear that Ordo was an exceptional woman. I absolutely agree with that statement. Although there were probably few, if any, of the female settlers quite like her, she shows the maximum a woman could achieve in the socially turbulent times of the Viking Age, deprived of the support of both husband and son. She had to take initiatives and undertake a male role if she was to get her family to Iceland. Having done so, she clearly commanded respect. In the more settled societies of Norway, where they came from, and Iceland as it became, women probably had fewer opportunities to play any other role than those of wife, mother, and housekeeper. Ordra took advantage of the greater opportunities and fewer social constraints in the Norse colonies of the British Isles, and that the later stories and legends about her, however romanticised, preserve a true picture of the possibilities opened up for women in the upheaval of the Viking movements. Beautifully well put, Judith. I couldn't agree with it more. So yes, she is a fascinating woman. It's always piqued my interest when I first read about her and how she, A, kind of like suffered the loss of the key male figures in her life, both her husband and then her son, but that she still had enough power and respect and influence over the other family members and those who served and worked under their family to then migrate everyone. To build a ship in secret, I mean, I don't know how many Norse shipwrights would have agreed to just a lone woman come in and say, can you build me a ship, but don't tell anyone. Like they think, like, why isn't your husband asking me to do this kind of thing? But yes, it's interesting. And of course, to do that voyage to Iceland, not always going well with the turbulence of seas and misdirection of the winds and whatnot. And just the fact that she had an influence then on Iceland and the place names. And it's just such a fascinating, absolutely fascinating life. And I want to know more. I want to know more about her. I think there should be a whole series about her, because it sounds dramatic. It sounds full of drama and intrigue. And it's almost a bit like, it just makes me think of echoes of kind of Elizabeth I kind of ruling alone. And of course, Emma of Normandy, who was a much later descendant of the Vikings, kind of making her own headway, getting through life with sons and kings and husbands dying off one after the other all around her, but still kind of like clinging to the power and taking influence and that kind of thing. So what do you two think about Ord or Nuna, whichever way?
Didn't she die sitting up too?
Like, I was just going to say that, yes, something. She died sitting up in bed.
Yeah. It didn't say it in there. We just know that she seemed to...
Well, it does in the saga, so...
Yeah, in the saga, it's like, almost like she out. Decided, like, now I'm going to die, and I'm going to die, you know, sitting up.
She told her son, prepare... she said to her son in the spring, she said, go find a wife. So he did. He went off to find a wife, and then they had a wedding feast. And she said, all right, now that you're married, I want the wedding the feast to go on 3 days longer. And because I'm going to die. And she did. 3 days, the feast continued, and then she retired to her bedroom, and she was found later sitting up in bed. So, yes.
Quite remarkable.
Uh-huh. There's a lot of details that didn't get included. Another thing is that two of her granddaughters were married off. One was in the Orkney Islands, and the other... Yeah. Shetlands or the Hebrides?
Shetlands
or the Faroes? Maybe it was the Faroes.
That's right. It was the Faroes.
Yeah, Orkney and the Faroes. Yeah. And then she arrived in Iceland.
And she did not ask those guys to build her a ship. She ordered them to. She was a very wealthy, powerful woman.
I was going to say she must have had the gold as well as
any males. She was the head of the household. Yeah. So she took male slaves with her as well. because it also says in the saga that she freed several of them and awarded them land. So, yeah.
And isn't one of the ways they claimed their land was like how far you could walk in one day or something like that is how much land you could have. Was that in that one or something? I'm maybe thinking of a different one.
No, that was a legend about a goddess. Remember we talked about her?
Ooh.
And she could plow in one day. But the other thing about in one of the sagas about Aud is she threw her pillars, her high seat pillars, which was a tradition. And it was just kind of mentioned. It wasn't really made a big deal of. But they didn't even say she threw her pillars overboard. They said she found her pillars, and that's why she decided to make her homestead where she did. But it was a tradition when you approached Iceland to throw your high seat pillars overboard, and then wherever they turned up, that's where the gods meant you to settle.
Mm.
Although she may have been a Christian by this time, she still went by the old traditions.
And whenever I read that story or hear that story, I think, how in the world did she keep that ship being built a secret? Because that's not a small feat to build a Viking ship.
Yeah, especially if it's enough to fit the people and her and all their belongings that she was taking with them. I'm presuming it was maybe at some distance, harbour or river opening, river mouth. I'm not sure where she was based when she was in the UK before that ship then set sail. It must have been near my side of the world to be on the west and then go to the Orkneys and then the Faroes. Oh no, Orkneys on the other way. That's the Shetland. Orkneys up that way, isn't it? I'm rubbish with geography, ladies and gentlemen. I only did a GCSE and never again. Another
Orkneys
book.
And Faroes, that's the route to Iceland. Those are like the traditional stops. And she married her granddaughters off to highborn men.
Yes.
Men worthy of them.
Weren't her descendants, I think they were also like, you know, pretty like kings and stuff of those places too.
They were jarls anyway, yeah.
Jarls, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Aud wasn't messing around.
No, I mean, because another book that does mention, and again, it's another recommended read of mine to any viewers and listeners watching, is Valkyrie, the Women of the Viking World by Johanna Katrin Friedrich's daughter. I had the pleasure of meeting her in person at my academic debut at the conference, the symposium in Stavanger in Norway. It will be on the YouTube channel. I can't remember the name of it now. That's really embarrassing. It was only in late August. Shows how bad my memory is generally. But yeah, she's got a nice section in here, more or less saying the same thing that Judith does in her book. But there's a little bit in here where it says, but Una is resourceful and she manages to get a ship built and presumably a sail woven or purchased, because of course women were vital in the sail industry. In secret, and sails off to Iceland with a large following and whatever movable property they could muster. The narrator assures us that people say it is hard to find another example of a woman managing to escape from such a hostile situation with as much wealth and as so many followers. It shows what an exceptional woman Una was. And yeah, it's just like even the sagas just can't praise her highly enough. And I just love that. I love that, because they're always singing praises about so-and-so and so-and-so, and they're always men. But it's nice that there are such women coming through in the sagas.
One of the things that I think I read about in this one, A Real Valkyrie by Nancy Marie Brown.
Oh, I'm halfway through that one.
That's a great one, too. She talks about that there were actually 13 women settlers in Iceland in the Landnámabók that settled without men. I mean, they didn't have men with them. They just came on their own volition and claimed land on their own. Nothing else is known about them except their names. They're listed in the book. And then there were other women who came with their husbands or with men in their family who were later widowed, you know, who were So there were, you know, a number of women homesteaders, but there were over 400 men homesteaders, and there were 13 women. So they were definitely in a minority, but they were there. They did do it. It must have been incredibly difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Well, here's my nomination for my favorite woman of history and sagas. Who was
yours? It's a good choice. I love Aud too. She's great.
I do too.
All right, so now we're over to me, and I chose Lagertha. Any listeners or viewers who are here will probably at least recognize that name from the TV show Vikings. Mm-hmm. She was the shield maiden wife of Ragnar Lothbrok. And her story comes from Saxo Grammaticus, his early work from the 13th century, the Gesta Danorum. Is it Gesta or Gesta? I don't know.
That's a good question.
I don't know if it's a soft G or a hard G. Anyway, I think it's just the norm. It means the deeds of the Danes. So, So he's got a bit about her. It's mostly the story is mostly about Ragnar as she shows up, a few times. Mm-hmm. So in the story starts with the fall of Ragnar's grandfather. He was a Norwegian king named Sigurd by another Swedish king whose name I can't pronounce. It's Fru, I'm not sure how. And this conquering king put all of King Sigurd's female family members into a brothel. Mm. And when word of this reached Ragnar that his grandfather had been conquered and they were mistreating the women this way, he decided to go and do something about it. Ragnar was the king of Jutland in Denmark at this time. And when Ragnar arrived in Norway, he was met by a group of women. All these women who had been put in the brothel and had been mistreated and abused, they all met him, and a lot of them were dressed up as men.
Mm.
So, yeah, because these women, they were ready to get a little revenge on this Swedish king. And I don't blame them. And so they had a big battle with Ragnar and this Swedish king, Fru. And during this battle, the women fought just alongside the men, and they were particularly brave, especially one woman who turned out to be Lagertha. And Ragnar even claimed that she turned the tide of the battle, this shield marrying. Yeah. And here's how Saxo described her. A skilled Amazon who, though a maiden, had the courage of a man and fought in front among the bravest with her hair loose over her shoulders. All marveled at her matchless deeds, for her locks flying down her back betrayed that she was a woman. So she was in the front lines, which is particularly brave. But I thought it was kind of interesting that her long hair down her back betrayed a woman, according to him. So I was like, does that mean that Viking men didn't typically wear their hair long? I don't know.
Yeah.
But I thought that was kind of an interesting little detail.
That's a good question. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because we have this image of Viking men with long hair often. So I was like, did they not? You would think you'd pull it back at least, like it would get in the way and be a hindrance. Anyway.
Mm.
So, but not only was she brave, she was also of noble birth, which was a bonus for Ragnar, because there's often classist tones, overtones in Norse stories. They really, so if she'd just been some regular woman, I don't think Ragnar would have been interested. I'm on this, serious. So then he returned home, but he was smitten by this courageous shield maiden. Mm. So he started sending her messages. And according to Saxo, she was not interested in Ragnar, but she let him think she was interested. So that gave him some confidence that he'd won over this woman. So he went to Norway to claim her. But he was in for a shock. And I can tell from Johanna's face that she knows. So out in front of her house, Lagertha had positioned two guardians. a dog and a bear. And I like to imagine that this dog was very large, like some giant wolfhound or something like that.
Yeah.
And then Ragnar, because he's this particular story's hero, defeats both of these guardians. And he killed by, you know, killing it with a spear, and the other he choked to death with his bare hands.
That must have been the bear.
Yeah, of course. Saxo doesn't say which one was which. Yeah. And that makes me think of Beowulf, you know, him. Didn't he, was it Grendel's mother he strangled with his bare hands? I don't remember.
I think it was. Yes.
So, and then according to Saxon, thus he had the maiden as the prize of the peril he had overcome. So he won the fair maiden, like a fairy tale. Except this doesn't have a happily ever after.
No.
But this is the Viking age, so there isn't a happily ever after. Mm. So they did marry, and they had two daughters who were unnamed, of course, and then a son named Fridleif. And they lived together in Norway for 3 years. But then there was some unrest back home in Denmark that drove Ragnar back. And then Lagertha stayed in Norway. And then during this time period is when Ragnar kind of stepped out on Lagertha. It's when he gets his nickname Hairy Breeches during this time. And he decided to marry another woman named Thora. So, and according to Saxo, Ragnar began to think ill of Lagertha's her trustworthiness, because she had set those two guardians up and led him on and everything. Like, to me, it sounds like your typical justification of a king who simply wants to get rid of this inconvenient wife and get another one.
I'm sure Henry VIII had exactly the same mindset.
Yeah, that went through my mind.
I think I want this wife now. Yeah. Mm. So then Lagertha, she remarried too, because they did get a divorce, which was not as difficult in the Viking age as it was later. And then Ragnar, back in Denmark, he ran into some trouble again. Some of his people were rising up against him. So he called for assistance from his Norwegian allies, including Lagertha. Yeah, and apparently the love she had for him still flowed deep and steadfast. So she and her husband and her son sailed with 120 ships to help out Ragnar.
That's really pretty impressive.
That's pretty huge. That's almost too big, I'm thinking.
Possibly an exaggeration.
I was going to say, it makes me think of Harald Hardrada's fleet when he first came, and then how few he left. Well, his son left with.
Yeah. And so and of course, just like when Ragnar attacked the king that had put her in a brothel, Lagertha saves the day. And this is what Saxo has to say. Lagertha, who had a matchless spirit, though a delicate frame, covered by her splendid bravery the inclination of the soldiers to waver, for she made a sally about and flew round to the rear of the enemy, taking them unawares, and thus turned the panic of her friends into the camp of the enemy. At last, the lines of Harald became slack, and Harald himself was routed with a great slaughter of his men. Yay, Lagertha! And I love that he used the phrase flew round to the rear of the enemy, because it makes me think of a Valkyrie and how they would fly over the battlefield. And she might also have been inspired by a Norwegian goddess named Thorgerd, who did something similar to Hakon Sigurdsson during a sea battle. He had sacrificed his son to her earlier.
Oh, gosh.
The guy.
I know. But when they had the sea battle, she like turned the wind against the enemy. And then she also threw arrows at the enemy. She shot arrows at the enemy and killed them all and helped out Hakon. Just that this woman coming in and kind of saving the day at the sea battle reminded me of that. So she could be linked to Thorgerd, there's always a like bit of legend in with all these historical type stories too. But unfortunately, but not surprisingly, for our hero Lagertha, Saxo did not have kind words for her in the end. So when she returned to Norway, she murdered her husband while he was asleep, and she, with a spearhead that she hid in her nightgown. And this is what he said about her. Then she usurped the whole of his name and sovereignty, for this most presumptuous dame thought it pleasanter to rule without her husband than to share the throne with him. So boo Saxo, but and I've never read anything. I don't know if there was somebody, you know, who did that, but anyway, but it's a very frustrating end to this pretty glorious story of this woman, this shield maiden woman who came to Ragnar's help twice and basically bailed him out. And then Saxo had to go and just cut her down at the very end. So,
and it wasn't like it wasn't common to, you know, knock off your rival for the throne, which is what her husband had apparently turned into.
Yeah, true.
You know, she wanted the throne herself, like many, many other men.
Right. It reminds me a little bit
okay,
of the way.
They did it.
Yeah, the way Gunhild, the mother of kings. Wait, is it Gunhild?
Yeah.
She's yeah, the way she was treated in history. Yeah.
Yes, very much so. And the TV show The Vikings, that first season, they really do a good job with, they don't stick exactly to the facts, but they really stick to the spirit of, you know, of the marriage between Ragnar and Lagertha and their divorce and then her coming to his aid, not with a fleet of 120 ships, but and also offing her husband, but she's a little more justified in the TV show. So I thought they did a really good job with that. Later on, they kind of go off the rails, but the first season or two were pretty good. And it was very cool just to see, you know, they did also a very good job of portraying what Viking life was like and, you know, their buildings and how they dressed and, you know, they got a little Hollywood-y on us, but they did, they really did a pretty good job that first couple seasons. I really liked it. And Lagertha was a main character throughout this series. And she was treated as a heroine in there. So that was good. That was, I liked their treatment of her.
Well, she was for the most part in this until the very, very end.
As long as she was, you know, not taking her own part.
Yeah, that's true.
But she's another very inspiring heroine.
Yeah, I must admit, I've not seen all of the Vikings series. I think I stopped at season 4. It was
probably a good place to stop.
I think it was.
That's after
I think it was
that
when his
sons
had grown up. So there was Ivar, Snake in the Eye, and then there was Bjorn, who would eventually become Ironside. And of course, I'd follow it up to the point of keeping an eye on how Rollo then took over Normandy and set that up. Because so few realise that Normandy means Land of the Northman. It has it has strong
and
Viking
Rollo
roots.
Rollo was not Ragnar's brother, but in the series, he's Ragnar's brother. And I don't think they were. I think they may have been contemporaries, but he wasn't the brother.
I don't know. Wasn't Rollo a little later?
Maybe later,
probably
later. Yeah. It's Netflix and just TV in general. They like to blend timelines.
Especially
what they've done with Vikings Valhalla, which is a complete spaghetti of history.
They really do it there.
I had to check out of that one because I was like, I can't have these people who weren't even like in the same alive at the same time, like talking to each other. It was
either really, really old or they're really young to not even like walk or talk yet. And it's just
right. I'm thinking, okay, Canute would have been like 8 years old when this guy was like, you know, that kind of.
I know.
And then like Leif Erikson was in. But anyway, I was just like, these people weren't intersecting. So I had a hard time with that one. I made it through the first couple. I liked the first couple seasons of Vikings, and then I just kind of ran out of steam. So now it's good to know that maybe it was a good time to stop.
Yeah, you didn't miss that much.
It was interesting, though. I will say that for them, they really gave Freydis her own kind of spotlight in the series as a female leader, not just kind of like making her kind of like the chosen one of all pagans, but throwing challenge after challenge at her, kind of like both in military, kind of like with men trying to usurp her and take over a little settlement of Jomsburg, but kind of giving her the challenge of finding safety, finding food, getting trade, kind of like that kind of thing. Because in season three, and I'm sorry if I'm going to spoil for you ladies, she makes it all the way back to Greenland, where she meets her dad, of course, Eric the Red. And he himself is not quite a nice heroic figure. He's quite controlling, quite dominant. He knows his people are starving and they're suffering, and then and they're living literally off rotten meat found upon the shore. That was a lovely scene. But he won't let Freydis and her people go because he needs his people to keep the settlement going. He needs their supplies, and he even kills her own captain and takes over her ship, so she literally cannot leave. She has to escape through subterfuge to go back to Kattegat, of course, the fictional settlement in Norway, to try and recruit a captain. And of course, rather ironically, she bumps into her brother, who has come all the way back from Constantinople, of course, where he's been all this time. But I really
say she was part of the Joms Vikings?
She was not.
She found,
never was in
the show. Because, yeah, I know she was not.
Not quite the Joms Vikings. They kind of like, they don't have an elite warrior cast there, but it's kind of like last remaining settlement of pagans, because of course Canute is Christian, therefore Norway's Christian, Denmark became Christian. So it's showing the lens of kind of like the dying out of the old ways and the rising of Christianity. I mean, in the very first episode of season three, Canute is meeting the Pope, and Canute is not liking how he has to act inferior towards the Pope. And he doesn't understand why the Pope won't talk to him. He's got to be his clergy, even though the Pope is sat right there. He's like, why can't he talk to me? He's right there. And the clergy's like, no, you do not address the Pope. We speak for the Pope. And he was like, why? I'm the greatest king of the North. Why can I not speak directly to him? There's some interesting things. And if you ever have the time, me and a couple of other special guests did a whole review of that season. Patricia Bracewell and Sharon Bennett Connolly, who of course is a great historian on women of history. I know she's got a really exciting book about Scottish queens coming out in the new year. But anyway, slightly off topic, the one thing that did ring my mind in the Vikings TV series about Lagertha was her scenes when she tried to kind of like run the settlement that they tried to found in what would be eventually the Danelaw. And I think it was King Guthrum, Alfred's dad, or Alfred the Great-to-be's dad, and how she kind of uses her womanly wily ways to kind of like canoodle up with him, but then kind of like keep her distance and keep her own little settlement and do their pagan things.
Guthrum,
I thought that was an
Alfred's
interesting
dad.
Was it not Alfred the Great's dad?
No. No, he was the leader of the great Viking army.
Oh, that Alfred I'm getting defeated. My names muddled up.
So, yeah.
I can't remember his name.
Dad was dead way before this started. I can't remember his father's name. He took Alfred.
Well,
the king
of Wessex area at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
She canoodled up with him.
I think Guthrum was a co-king of England at one point. So that might be what you're thinking of.
Maybe. Maybe
for a period of
it's
time.
Been a while, and parenthood has permanently addled my brain. So I'm good if I can remember names on most days, let alone historical names. Okay, so I think that's a really nice selection of historical women that, of course, you, dear viewers and listeners, please do go research. Find good books like these ones and the ones that our lovely guests have showcased. They are really worth the read. They're not that laboriously academic, and the pictures they create and the sources they mention are all genuine. So you can trust these books. Don't trust Netflix and TV dramas. They're kind of like taking a big heap of salt, basically.
But they are the Netflix shows are nice because you do get a picture of Viking lifestyle that in some ways is accurate, especially the first couple seasons.
Sorry, yes, please do divulge us with your wonderful female figure.
So Queen Ossa is mentioned in the Ynglingatal, and that's an ancient Scandinavian poem. And Snorri Sturluson imported that into his book, The Heimskringla, which is kind of the Bible of the saga, you know, of the sagas of the kings. So all the kings of Norway are mentioned in here. And Queen Åsa is in one of the earliest chapters. Snorri was writing in the early 1200s, like 1220. And Queen Åsa lived in the early 800s, which was the dawn of the Viking Age. And she was the daughter of a petty king. At that time, Norway was completely divided into at least 30 warring kingdoms. In fact, almost all of Europe was this way. England, you know, almost every country you can think of was this way. But there were all these petty kingdoms and all these warlords who called themselves kings or jarls. If they were subservient to a king, then they were a jarl. If they had people reporting to them, then they called themselves a king. And her father was a petty king of Agder, which is southern Norway. It's the southern part of Norway. His name was Harald Redbeard. And the king who was up above them in the north, a little north of them in Vestfold, was called Gudrid. And he had lost his wife. He had a grown son and he had lost his wife, and he went to Harald and said, I'd like to marry your daughter. And nobody knows for sure what the story is, but a lot of people think that Åsa said no. And so Harald said no. And he didn't like that very much. So Gudrid gathered all his men and launched an attack on Agder. And supposedly their headquarters was on the island of Tromøy, which is a very large island on the east coast of Norway. And they attacked at night and they defeated Harald and his son Gerd, who's Åsa's brother, and they took Åsa captive. So they took her back to Borre, which is where he had his kingdom. And she had a baby about a year later. And everything seemed to be going just very well for Gudrid until about a year later. And one night he was very, very drunk and he was getting off a ship and someone killed him with a spear.
Yes.
And that person, his assassin, was immediately killed. And in the morning when it was light, they discovered it was Queen Åsa's shoe boy. She had apparently commanded him to kill her husband, and he did. So as soon as that happened, she said, yes, it was done by my bidding. She took her son and she got on a ship and went back to her father's kingdom, where she ruled it for the next 18 years until he turned, her son was 18, so at least 17 years. Ooh. And she ruled alone. So in my book, I do change the facts a little bit because I just could not have a main character who would sacrifice a slave or a servant to kill her husband. So in my book, she kills him herself. And it goes through a long, long story about how that came about. And she essentially kills him in order to save her son. And she does go back to Agder and she takes up the reins, and then nothing else is heard of her. Her son was Halfdan the Black, who was the father of Harald Fairhair. And those kings are historical. She's historical as Harald Fairhair's grandmother. But we don't hear another word about her, even though we know pretty sure that she ruled alone for 17, 18 years until her son was of age. In the Viking Age, so I thought, wow, this is a very interesting woman. I'm going to have to write about her. So I have, at this point, after the first book, which does follow history to a certain point, I'm imagining in 6, and now I'm working on book 7, what life must have been like for her. It's been very fun. I still have not run out of stories about her. And I've also brought in a lot of the mythology of the time period, because they were definitely not Christian. They meet Christians, but they are not Christian. And they're not even close to being converted at this point. Norway doesn't convert until the 900s, when when they get a Christian hawk on the good. And they only convert for a little while.
Yeah.
And then they off hawk on and they, because the crops are bad and they go back to their pagan ways. So it's really around the year 1000 that they become truly Christian. But anyway, Osa lived in the early 800s. We don't know the exact year, but there is a lot of belief that she may be the person who's buried in the Osberg burial ship, which is one of the reasons they call it the Osaberg burial ship. Now, nobody knows for sure who that person, there are two women buried there, no men, just two women. And it is the most resplendent ship burial in all of Scandinavia. It's a beautifully carved ship with 30 oars. It's 70 feet long. It was loaded with ornately carved sleighs, a very, very old carved cart that they believed may have belonged to a sorceress or a priestess. There were tapestries that show us, they're actually the only real pictures that we know of that show us what people might have looked like. Now they're very cartoonish, but we can see how they dressed. The men wore these, they're almost like kilts, but they're a divided wide-legged pants and they are patterned. They look like they have some very fancy woven patterns on them. And the women all wear these shawls that are also ornate, and they wear these long dresses with trains. And there are over 20 shield maidens portrayed on these weavings. And the weavings date back to around, 830, somewhere in that time period. So we did show them as having women in these tapestries are portrayed as sorceresses, they're portrayed as warriors, they're portrayed as shamans. There are men and women portrayed as shamans and warriors. And they all wear, there's a man in a bear costume, two men in bear costumes, there's two women in boar costumes. They both are carrying weapons. There's two shield walls of women as well as shield walls of men. So we don't know what these tapestries are telling a story, but we just don't know what the story is yet. We may never know. A archaeologist, Marianne Videller, who's from the University of Oslo, she wrote a book called The Osberg Tapestries. And she goes into a lot of what we know about what they're telling us in these tapestries. It's a fascinating read, and unfortunately you can't get it in the United States. You can get it in the Scandinavian countries, and that's about it. So I've been able to borrow a copy from interlibrary loan, but I haven't been able to buy a copy. Maybe someday. Anyway, it's a fascinating, the Osberg ship is fascinating, whether it was her burial or not. There's some quibbling about the dates, which I understand, but to tell you the truth, I think it really is her, because who else could it be? There isn't anybody else in any stories that it could be. So we don't know. And
that's
the same
a very
way
good with, point.
Yeah, the Gokstad ship is probably Olaf, who was Gudrid's son, and he became the king of Vestfold once his father died. Or it could also be Olaf's son, which is Ronvald the Mountain High, and he became a mighty king as well. And depending on the dating, it might be his Olaf's son, not Olaf himself. Anyway, I love archaeology. I get really carried away with it.
It's a very good point, because history is full of stories of kings, their lives, their deaths, how they're remembered, good or bad, like Ethelred the Unready, the Ill-Advised, for example. But nothing much about the queens, because I know I've got a book on my bookshelf in the lounge about Ethelred's mum. I know I've got, like, Sharon Bennett-Cotley, my previous guest in a previous episode. She's written about the women behind the Norman Conquest, so she looks at William the Conqueror's wife, Matilda, and, of course, Harold Godwinson's and Harald Hardrada's one or two wives, I think. But yes, in terms of Scandinavian queens, certainly kind of like we, considering we're literally across their next door neighbours via the sea, we know zero. We know all about the King Harald Hardrada and Swain Forkbeard and King Canute, but nothing about the queens. And of course, the daughters are always married off to anywhere else, and then we don't hear from them again, which is a real shame.
Because they didn't write down their history until after the year 1000, when they became Christian. So by the time, you know, they didn't write much history at all. And when Snorri Sturluson came along, it was 1220 when he wrote this book. So it was 400 years later. And they were thoroughly Christianized. He was in Iceland. He wasn't Norwegian. He was writing it for the Norwegian king. But of course they left women out, because by that time, women were kind of an afterthought in their society. Things had changed drastically for women after the year 1000. So just like it did in Anglo-Saxon England, but Anglo-Saxon England was Christianized long before the conquest.
Yeah.
But they were not Roman Catholic to begin with. They wrote a lot, but they also showed us women's rights in Anglo-Saxon England were much different than they were after the conquest. In fact, I wrote a whole paper about that.
We have a whole podcast about that.
We do.
Do we have two episodes or one?
It was so long it turned into two podcasts.
Yep. All your episodes are fascinating. I know when I was preparing for my academic debut at the Mari Symposium, I remembered it. It returned to my brain, ladies and gentlemen. The Mari Symposium in Stavanger, which was looking at the Middle Ages relevance, retelling and inspiration in the 20th and 21st century. And I was, of course, I've always been curious about the figures of Valkyries, and we will get on to the mythology side. Don't worry, dear viewers and listeners, we're getting there. A Valkyrie, and of course, one Valkyrie in particular, of course, is Brynhild of Sigurd and Fafnir fame. And of course, I listened to your wonderful first debut podcast about Brynhild and her different interpretations and in the sagas and the core texts. Because of course, not many people know about that source material. Most people think either Richard Wagner in the Ring Cycle, or the infamous Bugs Bunny episode where the hunter is Sigurd and Bunny dresses up as Brynhilda, supposedly, on a horse with long plaits in her hair. One fascinating interpretation. But yes, it was interesting learning more about her background and how she appears as this kind of mythological character, and then she magically transforms into kind of like a maiden in a tower in a keep, where he goes and falls in love with her because his eagle flies up to a tower, or hawk, whatever is flying around. And it's kind of like, oh, Rapunzel, very much that kind of romanticized, even kind of back then when it was being recorded. But yes, absolutely fascinating. And of course, Snorri does have a lot of influence in terms of the women and how they're portrayed in the mythology side. So that is where we will go next. So my goddess that I've chosen, because you can pick other female deities and beings. There's Norns, there's witches, there's vulvas, there's giantesses. Other spirits galore is Freya, because of course she's awesome. And the name is still popular in the 21st century. And I got this beautiful book, Dawling Kindersley. Their books are just
It's beautiful. Gorgeous.
I found it in the children's section to do with folklore and fairy tales, and I said, it's coming home. It's coming home with me. And the artwork is very simple but abstract. And there's Freya and her twin brother Frey. But there she is with her big cats. And they're not house cats, dear viewers and listeners. She never had a chariot pulled by house cats. They were fearsome, fearsome felines. Fearsome felines. So in this one, it says, Freya is a goddess of the Vanir tribe. She is associated with love, beauty, fertility, and magic. She rules over a place in the afterlife, a meadow called Folkvanger, and half of all warriors who die in battle go to her. Which is why I think she's awesome, because that's level pegging with Odin there, folks. The rest stay with Odin, so kind of considering how power-hungry and paranoid Odin is just about the end of everything and not knowing enough, you'd think he wouldn't give a soul away, but no, he does. He gives half to her. Apparently, in this book, her parents are Njord and possibly Nerthus, who I've not heard of before, and her children are Hanos and Josemi. Again, I don't know much about them, so that'll be interesting for me to look up. She's got a few sacred items. She's got her Brisingamen amber necklace. It's her most prized possession. Kind of as Odin covets knowledge, Freya covets pretty things. She has falcon feather cloak, which allows her to change into a bird and fly all over the place, and that gets used quite a lot in the myths. Not often by her, but usually by the other gods, because they get into trouble and need her help. She does have a chariot, which is pulled by two cats, and I do refuse to think of them as house cats. They were very, very big cats. But she does also have a giant boar called Hildsvini, which means battle swine. But she is most commonly described as an enchantress. She is well practiced in magical arts called Seder, which is a very female, feminine art form of magic. She teaches Odin spells and potions and how to see into the future. So again, Odin is gaining a lot from her. He doesn't know it all, she does. And close to nature, Freya has animal familiars, or Frigga, including the boar, Hildisvini, and there's... and these help or guide her. So that's one book that covers Freya. It's a beautiful book, beautiful artwork. It does actually have a nice couple of pages about Brynhilda the Valkyrie as well. Another book, which again is another friend to read, is this one. Goddesses. 50 goddesses, spirits and saints and other female figures that have shaped belief. And this is written by the wonderful Dr. Yanina Ramirez, who champions Queen Emma. So I salute her, because Queen Emma for the win all the time. And it's by the always awesome British Museum. So again, beautiful institute.
Didn't that author write that book Femina?
She did. I haven't read it yet. I've read the first few chapters.
Yeah, it was very good. It's very good.
I recommended it to one of my mum friends who teaches sociology to a degree at university, and she listened to an audiobook and she just kept writing loads of it into her seminars and lectures because it said it so well.
Yeah.
I just need more time to read. That's what I need.
I know.
So this is the wonderful two-page spread on Freya. And again, she has two cats. And again, I think they should be a lot bigger, like lion-sized.
Yeah.
I'm not going to read all of it because there's a lot. It covers a few of her key legends and how her different magical items have helped. But it says, she is no one's fool. Of all the women in the Norse or Viking religion, Viking with exclamation marks, Freya is one of the most important. Wherever the Vikings reached on their extraordinary longships, the goddess and her stories travelled with them. Symbolic of love, springtime, beauty, gold and magic, Freya is fearless, feisty and temperamental. She's also a woman at home on the battlefield. She moves among the dead, and her assistants, the feared Valkyries, choose half of all the warriors killed in battle to live with her in the field of the people, known as Folkvang. Freya can travel across the nine realms on her chariot pulled by two dark grey cats, or she rides a powerful boar, Hildsvini. She also has a cloak of falcon feathers that allows her to fly. And again, it's just quite a magnificent, almost Boudicca-esque representation of her there. But it's interesting that at least Dr. Yanina Ramirez suggests that she visited the battlefield directly, and that the Valkyries are subservient to her as well as Odin, which is interesting. Because that's one issue I've always been curious about. It's like, how much agency did the Valkyries have? Were they always following Odin's orders, or were they kind of like always wanting to do their own thing?
Isn't there some name for Freya that calls her the goddess of the Valkyries? Or I can't remember.
That sounds right.
Seems like I'd have to look it up.
And the stories of the Valkyries have changed too. So there's that story in Ireland where the guy comes across those 12 women who are in that hut, and they're using the skulls as the warp weights, and you know, all that kind of stuff. It's very
perfect Halloween scene. Perfect Halloween scene.
Oh, yes. Cool.
I need to add that to my list as well.
But then there's later stories where they fall in love with humans and things like that. So they changed. The stories have changed over time too.
They do. I was remembering you were talking about cats, and I don't know if you can see this picture or not, but this is the stern of the cart on the Osberg burial ship, and it's carved with cats. They're all cats. And some of them are crying. Some of them are wiping their little kitty eyes. Oh. We don't know what that means. We think it has something to do with Freya, and maybe one of the women in the burial was a priestess of Freya. But this cart was very old. It was quite a bit older than the ship. So anyway, the cat thing just made me think of that. It's such an amazing, the wagon itself is, it's not very big, but it's elaborately carved.
That's a fascinating connection. Thank you for sharing. I've heard, of course, of the Osberg burial, but I've never really read that much into it, but it's just always sounded fascinating. And I would love to get to see any of it in the actual museum, because I think it's still in one of the museums. Is it in Oslo?
It's been put in storage because they're building a new museum for it.
And they are, aren't they?
Yeah, it'll open in 2027. And the reason they're building a new museum is that the vibration from people's footsteps was starting to make it disintegrate.
Blimey.
That and the Gokstad ship as well. Mm. So they had to, that's the reason they absolutely had to make a new museum, a new place for it. So,
wow, that is fragile. Yeah.
Well, I was just watching a special on it, and the wood had been preserved with alum on the ship and all the things that came off of it. And if you can crumble it, it's barely holding together. So it's very, very fragile. I mean, when you realize it's, more than 1200 years old, and I just feel really fortunate that I've seen it three times. And maybe I'll make it back for 2027. That would be great.
We'll have to make a group trip, because I remember being the Jorvik Viking Festival Symposium by the Richard Hall Symposium, as it's known, and I remember the director of the museum coming and talking to us about the plans and showing us the concept art and how it's still keeping the cross section, but they're just making a big curve, and interior looked amazing, and I'm glad COVID and pandemic and finances haven't stopped it.
During COVID, they did put a moratorium on the finances, and now it's picked back up. But it was pretty dire there during the pandemic. It was a really dire situation.
Didn't they do a fundraiser? I think I remember them doing a fundraiser.
They did. But they have a Facebook page, and every now and then they'll post an update on there. So
I'll have to go look that up. I will try and add the link in the description below, dear viewers, once this video goes live. Okay, but yes, she is my favourite character. When I used to dabble in creative writing, I distinctly remember writing a particular scene where she was walking around the battlefield and Odin was choosing who he wanted. And I took the most delight in having her kind of like lick some blood off Voldemort's sword and just kind of like seductively, naughtily, and it's like, oh, I think I'll have this one kind of thing, just to make it kind of seem a bit darker, a bit more almost like more powerful, but in a naughty way. It didn't go very far, that scene, at all. I just had fun writing it. But the fact that she is not from the Azir tribe, so she is an outsider to Odin in his particular clan, but also she's been reinterpreted and represented in so many different ways in different mediums in our current century. Of course, the cat thing is still very much there. Everyone matches Freya instantly equals cats. I know when I played the Assassin's Creed Vikings Valhalla History Tour, which is a lovely kind of like playthrough without the combat and the stealth and the stabby stabby, you just kind of like learn and role play through history, both on the north side and as a Christian monk, which was an interesting mix. You do eventually find your way to Valhalla, sorry, spoilers, and you do meet Freya, and she's there carving turnips instead of pumpkins, which was an interesting thing. And she's surrounded by huge, giant, fluffy cats, which you can reach down and pet in character, which is adorable. But she seems more like kind of like a nice innkeeper of a woman, more than kind of like a fierce goddess who can do magic or anything. So she was very tamed down in that representation. But she's I know there's been a recent series called Twilight of the Gods with a certain Zack Snyder involved on Netflix, and Freya is in that one. She's got very strong veneer ties, and she's definitely got prophetic abilities, which she claims to have given up when she was taken by ransom and then married to Odin to end the Æsir Vanir war. They've twisted it a little bit. There's no Frigg, there's just Odin and Freya. And Valkyries as well, but they don't seem to have any connection to her either. But yes, so she's been an interesting one to follow. And of course, Freya as a name is still popular in today's culture. I did want to name my daughter that, but my husband said no, because you like Vikings and just no. So Naomi it is. So a bit of Greekness instead of Norseness. But yes, I just think, unfortunately, because Snorri himself wrote all these sagas, he was choosing or not choosing what to write down. And nearly all the books I've read, including like these two, they both say to some degree that there were probably a lot more sagas or legends about the Norse female spirits and goddesses or even giantesses, but they have been lost because they were not chosen to be written down. They were not part of what Snorri wanted to present in his poetic and prose Edda and that kind of thing. So yeah, so
pretty much
my candidate for a good figure of Norse mythology to look for if you're looking for a powerful woman. Because she was, I think. Totally. So Kim, who is,
hey, can I plug
choice?
One of my books that has,
yes,
Freya and Valkyries in it? It's called A Deal with Odin.
I love that book.
Oh, thanks. It's a very short book, so it's quick and
it's really fun.
Freya has a cameo in it, and then there's a few Valkyries. So yes. Oh. And can I push one more thing?
Go
I have a since you mentioned Odin, I have a short story in an anthology that just came out. It came out in the UK. I don't know when it came out in the UK. It's coming out in the US tomorrow. It's going to be released tomorrow.
Oh, congratulations. That's great.
Oh, thanks. It's by Flame Tree Publishing, and it's an anthology devoted to Odin, and it's all stories about Odin.
They have some beautiful books, and I found this one at Barnes and Noble.
Oh my gosh.
So this is what they are beautiful books.
Wow. Okay.
So what's the title of the anthology, Kim, then?
It's just called Odin.
Keep it simple and short. Yeah, makes sense. I will look it up. I will find the link and it'll be down below. And I personally will add it to my Christmas wish list.
Yeah.
I just get my husband to buy me more books that he then can't fit anywhere because I don't have a library.
Then you have to get him to buy you a library to go with it.
There you go.
I wish he could buy me a bigger house so I could have my own little Becky cave, as I keep wanting to call it. Just have all my Norse books out and all my Norse art, and just not have curtains or a very cramped bookcase as a backdrop. But anyway, dear viewers, we do what we can. So here we are.
We
so Kim, all right. Who's your choice?
I do love Freya. I decided to, I chose Skathi. Maybe because she's not a goddess. She's a Jotun. And who married, just like Freya was not originally an Aesir goddess, Skathi is a Jotun and marries into the Aesir gods. So she's usually associated with winter. Sometimes she's called the snowshoe goddess. And she's known for loving like the high snowy mountains. And she's usually depicted on skis and hunting with like a bow and arrow. And she loves her mountain home of Thrymheim, which means thunder home. So I think that's very cool. So, and actually her name means scathe. So it's the same. So it's very similar to our English word.
Interesting.
So, yes, and as her name implies, Skathi is no pushover. She's she's pretty fierce. So she is the daughter of Thjazi, and he was the Jotun who kidnapped the goddess Idun and stole the apples of immortality.
With Loki's help.
Yes. With Loki's help.
It's got Loki's fingerprints on it.
And you mentioned Freya's falcon cloak. Well, Loki uses that to go and rescue Idun and get those mm-hmm. apples back, because without their apples of immortality, the gods and goddesses were all dying.
Yep.
And so Thiazi discovered that, Loki had stolen Idun back. And as he passed over the walls of Asgard, the gods killed him. So if there's one thing I think we all know, that if you kill a loved one in the Norse world, that's not going to go unchallenged by their family members. Nope. So Skathi wanted revenge for her father's death. So she put on her helmet and coat of mail and, taking all her weapons of war, set out for Asgard to avenge her father. But the gods did not want to spill blood in Asgard. And I also think they were a little intimidated by her. So, and although she was far outnumbered and Thor was there and everything, they determined to reconcile with her instead. And they offered that she could marry one of the gods, but she could only choose them by looking at their feet. So the male gods all lined up behind a curtain with only their feet showing. And since Skathi is intelligent, she chose the one who had the cleanest, most attractive feet, assuming that it was the god Baldur, who was particularly beautiful. But it was not Baldur.
She just needs Scylla Black, and then it would have been Norse blind date. It just didn't happen, unfortunately.
That'd be a funny story. Like,
God rest you, Scylla.
Oh my goodness.
She was a woman.
Those lovely feet belonged to the sea god Njord, who was Freya and Freya's father. And I guess maybe being a sea god means you have clean feet. You must be in the water a lot. And so
it's all the minerals in the water.
Yeah. But before she would leave Asgard with her new husband, she had one more condition for the Aesir. They had to make her laugh. And like, you obviously know it's coming, because this is where it gets very strange. So to make Skathi laugh, Loki, he fetched a rope and a billy goat. And already this is kind of bizarre. And he tied one end of the rope to the goat's beard and one to his own testicles. And they proceeded to have a tug of war. And I know. So they tugged and they tugged, and they were both squealing in pain until Loki fell over and fell into Skathi's lap. And that made her laugh, which would make me laugh too. So anyway, so I guess all was well. The conditions were met. She chose her husband and they made her laugh. And then Odin threw her father, his Thiazi's eyes into the sky, where they became two stars. I kind of like that. I kind of like that she was able to look up in the sky and see her father's eyes. But unfortunately, it seems like I have this a lot. There's no happy ending. Skathi and Njord, they didn't have a happy marriage. He was a sea god and she was a Jotun of the snow and the mountains. But they did. They gave it a try. Njord had a hall that was by the sea, and Skathi had her hall in the mountains. And there were wolves at the mountains and seagulls at the sea, and lots of issues. But they agreed to try something. They would live in Thrymheim for 9 nights and Njord's hall for 3 nights. And then after the 9 nights were over, Njord had had enough of the cold and the snow and the wolves howling outside the hall. He said that the mountains were hateful to him and the howling of wolves sounded ugly. He was more used to the song of swans. So he wasn't happy. So then they moved to his hall by the sea. And now Skathi wasn't happy. She couldn't sleep because the gulls were screeching and the sea kept her awake. So they couldn't agree on a marital abode. So they decided they would just live separately. He would stay in his place by the sea and she'd go up to the mountains. And they never lived together again. But it actually it seems like a pretty
amicable split,
especially considering how the Norse gods could be. And she did become incorporated into the Aesir family, and then she treated Njord's children, Freya and Freyr, as if they were her own.
Mm.
But then Skathi has one more part to play in the mythology. Oh, Johanna has that wicked
laugh. I'm waiting for this.
So in the poem,
not that long ago.
I know. It's a So in the Lokasenna, and this is a poem, I think it should be subtitled Loki Behaving Badly. Because he killed a servant and he insulted all of the gods and goddesses in attendance, including Skathi. So they ended up punishing Loki ultimately, not after this. Mm. Eventually he killed the god Baldur. Or he arranged for Baldur's kill Baldur.
Yeah.
And then Loki fled and the other gods caught up with him. And their punishment, which was pretty gruesome, is they bound him with the entrails of his own son.
Mm.
So that's much more Norse-like than everybody getting along. And Skathi is the one who, she dangled a serpent over Loki's head that drips poison onto his face.
Mm.
So she got her revenge for him insulting her. I'm sure he claimed she slept with everybody or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
That was his go-to. Who was basically slut-shaming every woman in the hall. So, yeah. So nobody gets away with killing her father or insulting her. So, yeah. So she's pretty awesome.
She is. I love her.
Yeah.
Have either of you read The Witch's Heart by Genevieve Cornshaw?
Mm-hmm.
That's on my to be read list.
you'll like the Skathi in that book.
Okay.
She fits the description and the imagery and the poetic scenes that you've described really, really well. Really, really
isn't
well.
That one about Angerboda?
It mm-hmm. is, it but is. Skathi also okay. features in it.
Okay.
As well Skathi's as
Loki. One of her friends, one of Angerboda's okay. girlfriends.
Mm. So, yeah.
Yes. Yes, that's Skathi.
Well, speaking of Angerboda.
Ah.
So he was. Yeah. So my I'm talking about Hel. That's the one I chose, the person I chose. She's also a Jotun. She's not a goddess. She's mentioned in the prose Edda Gylfaginning and the poetic Edda Völuspá, as well as she's mentioned in passing in quite a few poems and sagas, as usually as a kenning or something. But she was the daughter of two Jotuns, Loki and Angerboda. And contrary to popular belief, Loki was not a god. He was a Jotun, but he was Odin's blood brother, and that's how he got his entree into Asgard. And Loki also had an Aesir wife named Sigyn, right? Isn't that right? Kim Sigyn, isn't that the name? And she held a little bowl over Loki's head when the serpent was dripping poison to keep the poison off of his head. But every now and then she had to empty the cup and when it got full, and then Loki would scream until she came back. Anyway, Angerboda was his wife, his Jotun wife, and she lived in Jotunheim, and they had three children. Her name, Angerboda, is she who offers sorrow. That's what her name means. Mm-hmm. So their children were Fenrir the wolf, Jormungandr, who is the world serpent, and their daughter is Hel. So the gods found a prophecy that told them that Loki's brood would cause great mischief and disaster would arise from them. Well, they got a little worried. So one day when Angerboda was away, they went into her hall in Jotunheim and kidnapped her children and took them to Odin. Odin cast Jormungandr into the sea, where he, of course, became the world serpent. And they tried to bind Fenrir, but it took quite a bit of doing. They finally had the dwarves make a fetter made of the sound of a cat walking, the breath of a fish, and the hair from a woman's beard. And that finally did the trick, although Tyr did lose his hand. Fenrir did his hand off in revenge. And Hel was cast into Niflheim, which is behind the third root of Yggdrasil. And she was given charge of all the dead sent to her, which is namely those who do not die in battle, but die of sickness and old age. So I'm going to read a little passage, a description of Hel and her home, from my book, The Queen of Hel, which is
wonderful. Thank you.
Because I did a lot of research to come up with this description, so I feel pretty confident in it. So Ossa and her Volvahyde are approaching Hel's home because they're trying to save her people from a plague. They had covered a lot of ground quickly, and now in the distance, a storm cloud hovered over the roof of a great hall, sending sleet down upon the thatched roof. Elhudnir, Hel's hall, said Hyde. As they drew near, Ossa could see that the cloud sat stationary over the hall. They walked into the storm, blinded by sleet that stung like needles, struggling against a headwind that seemed determined to blow them away from their goal. By the time they fought their way to the door, they were soaking wet and shivering. Ossa brushed the sleet from her eyes, and the door was twice as tall as she was. It was made of oak, intricately carved with twining beasts, whose eyes were red jewels. The creatures seemed to writhe and flick their tongues at her. Hyde raised her iron staff and pounded on the door, sending the beasts scattering through the cracks. Nothing happened. Hyde pounded again, uttering spells that demanded entrance. They seemed to do the trick, for the door creaked open to reveal a dim interior. In the gloomy recesses, something moved. A voice came, faint as the groan of a dying man.
Who knocks on my lady's door?
I am the Volvahyde, and with me is Ossa, Queen of Agder. Ossa shivered at the compelling Galdr tones in the sorceress's voice. Do not hinder us. We have urgent business with your lady.
My lady sees no one, moaned the voice.
The wind shrieked at their backs as if trying to tear them from the doorway. Let us pass, or I will curse you, said Hyde. A laugh like a rusty hinge emanated from the shadows.
I fear no curses. Nothing worse could be done to me than to be doomed to stay here until Ragnarok.
Hyde seemed to grow, her shadow looming in the darkness. I have powers of which you do not know. I can curse you in ways you have never imagined. Her voice resonated into the room. You will let us pass. After a long pause, a sigh escaped the shadows.
Very well, witch. Enter if you dare.
Ossa stepped forward, but Hyde flung out her staff and blocked her way. Ossa looked down and gasped. Beneath her feet yawned a vast pit, nearly invisible in the gloom. It stretched the width of the entry, so deep she could not see the bottom. Beyond the pit came a chuckle.
Mind the gap.
Follow me, said Hyde. I had to put that in there. from the underground in London. Yes. Mind the gap in every train. Follow me, said Hyde. Gathering her robes in one hand, she sprang across the pit. Ossa looked into the depths and quailed, but if the sorceress could make the jump, so could she. She took a deep breath and launched herself into the air. She fairly flew across the chasm, landing beside the Volva. Come, said Hyde. With dread in her heart, Ossa turned and followed the sorceress into the dim interior. The air was thin and smelled of rotting things. The servant who had greeted them materialized from the gloom, a look of disappointment on his face. He was thin as a skeleton and gray as the walls. His hair hung in stringy hanks. His jowls sagged, and he wore a robe of faded rags. He carried an iron staff.
I am called Ganglati, follow me. And Ganglati means lazy man. Ganglati led them through the entryway into another oaken door, bound with brass and swarming with carved serpents. He struck the door as Hyde had done, and the beasts scattered. Then he pushed the door open and stood aside. Within, a long fire blazed, casting a dull light, but the room was frigid. Icy water dripped from the thatch, and snow covered the rushes on the floor. If anything, it was colder inside than out. The ceiling seemed to writhe, and as she stared upwards, Osa saw that the roof was thatched with living serpents woven together. It was their venom that dripped, hitting the frozen floor with a sizzle. The benches lining the wall were empty, but the far end of the hall, there was a high seat that was occupied. A tall woman, richly dressed, sat there. At her feet lay an enormous wolf, twice the size of those who had chased them through the iron forest. He was bound by what appeared to be a silk ribbon to a boulder, sunk into the floor as if it had been hurled there by a mighty force. Osa sucked in her breath, and the wolf eyed them, slathering. Beside him sat the most beautiful man Osa had ever seen. This is Balder. His golden hair shone and his smile lit the gloom, and from his arms hung golden chains. The woman gazed at him in adoration. In profile, the woman's face was hidden by her long dark hair. She turned her head toward them as they entered, and Osa gasped. One side of her face was young and beautiful, the other a rotting corpse, a shade of blue so dark that it was almost black. So that's wow. Those are all descriptions taken from the sagas and from the poems.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. That was a real treat.
It was fun. That's probably the most fun to write of any of the things that I've ever written. So Hel, in the poem Baldur's Dream, Odin rides Sleipnir to Hel to find out why his son is having these nightmares, and he finds out that from a vulva who's buried near Hel's gates, that all of Hel is preparing to receive Balder. So he knows his son is going to die. And Frigg, his mother, Balder's mother, asks everything in the world to swear that they won't harm her son. And they all do, except for the mistletoe, which is just a little thing and too young to swear an oath. So that is what Loki uses to trick Baldur's brother into killing him with. And I won't go into that whole sad story, but Hel gets Baldur. Mm-hmm. And Baldur's other brother rides on Sleipnir to beg Hel to give his brother back to the gods. And she says, well, I will, as long as everything living or dead in all the nine worlds swear that they would weep for him. And so Frigg goes out and everything in all of the worlds weeps for Balder, except one old Jotun woman who says, let Hel hold what she has. And some think that may be Loki. So the prophecy that the Aesir gods feared does come true, and at Ragnarok. And Ragnarok, Hel plays a major role of leading the armies of Hel against the Aesir. Her brothers take care of Odin and Thor. And that's the end of the world. I think that's also the end of Hel. They don't really say what happens to her.
No.
I know Jormungandr and Thor fight, and they kill each other, basically. Thor kills the world serpent, but the world serpent has bitten Thor, so he's poisoned, and he goes nine steps, and he dies. Fenrir swallows Odin. And Loki sails the ship made of fingernails
called Melfager. I can't pronounce it right.
But that just that sounds right. Disgusting.
Close.
The unworthy dead.
Gross.
Well, it's interesting because I'm not going to talk about it too much, but Genevieve Cornishek addresses that anomaly of what happens to hell at the end of all things in an interesting way, I think. Because I guess she's a goddess that we just know the bare bones and the basics of her. And of course, we know she's described as half a corpse, but no one knows kind of like anatomy, can't say the word. Her anatomy, whether it's straight down the middle or whether it's just at the waist. I've always curious about those who interpret that as meaning at the waist, or maybe like her legs are so withered that she couldn't walk, kind of like representing disability. Again, it's a thing that's always been fascinating me about the general whole pantheon, that they're none of them are perfect by any means. I mean, they all need to eat fruit to stay young. And of course, Tyr loses a hand. There's Hermod the Blind. Odin with his one eye. So, yeah, I mean, Sif loses her hair. She needs a wig, but that was Loki, so can't really blame it on natural causes. But yes, there's just so many. And of course, Hel does have one companion, because isn't there a female giantess that guards the gate to prevent the dead going back to the living?
Mordred.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting, just like not a male. I mean, there is a dog as well. She does have a dog, I believe, somewhere down
there. The hellhound.
Mm, that's it.
They're all, I put them all in my story. It's a long journey to hell. Very interesting story.
Yeah. I mean, have either of you read The Monstrous Child by Francesca Simon?
No.
That's an interesting book. It's written for children, but I'd definitely say more of a teenager type, because she herself is a teenager. And this whole series of Valhalla conversations started with me having a beautiful conversation with her, Francesca Simon, and Joanne Harris and Professor Caroline Larrington. And it was not long after The Monstrous Child had actually been transformed into an opera and performed in London and reserved great reviews. But it's all told from Hel's perspective. It's fascinating. It's an interesting read narratively. It's not quite diary-esque, but it's all kind of like, oh, I did this and then I did that and I can't believe they've done this to me. And you really get a lot of teenage fury coming through and injustice to get the words, like, how dare they put me down here? And interesting scenes when her father turns up and exploring that dynamic of father and daughter relationship, because a lot of the time those two characters are met in all the fiction I've read, it's not been a happy father-daughter relationship at all. But interestingly enough, the Twilight of the Gods series on Netflix, with the infamous Zack Snyder's influence, although he only directed 2 episodes and there's 8, Hel does play a bit more of a role, and she's definitely more supportive of her father, and her father is definitely being more of a, Loki's more of a father figure in the series, without spoiling too much. It comes out that he's quite protective of his daughters and indeed his son, because of course he knows what's going to happen to them, as well as Odin. And as much as he doesn't want to see Odin fight and kill them, he doesn't want them to fight and kill Odin unless they can kill Odin and get away with it, kind of thing. But yes, it's an interesting angle that I never thought I'd see come out regarding Loki being kind of either kind of like the anti-hero or the kind of the underdog, or just the general trickster that everyone likes because he's the trickster. But it was interesting. And the depiction of Hel, she also has horns, which I'm not quite keen on, but I'll forgive them their artistic license, because nearly all interpretations have artistic license, because we don't have pictures of what these gods look like. We just have these words, which themselves are several hundred years old after they were first spoken and that kind of thing. So that's really interesting. So we've had like Freya, the goddess of enjoying life very much, because she's always been associated with carnal love and sex and lust and sexual activity. I mean, she's always accused of having affairs with all the gods, but she doesn't really. She has a husband, but she kind of like weeps for him because he always goes off without her. I can't remember his name.
She did sleep with all the dwarves.
His name is Odd.
She did Odd. Do the dwarves. That's it. She did do the dwarves. That's
what she got for Singerman for it.
She got something out of it, yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting. And of course, so we've had Freya, Hel, and then we've had,
oh my gosh, my memory. Where is it Scathy. Going tonight?
Scathy, sorry. I apologize, Kim. I've forgotten things both of you said, and I am genuinely listening. I do apologize.
It's kind of late where you are.
It's pretty late.
I mean, that's very kind of you to blame it on the time, but my memory is scattered most of the time. Anyway, my husband would attest to that. I'm often speaking to him, and he'll go, can you say that again, but in English? Because I literally cannot speak English. but I generally just get too excited about all these things. But yes, all the books, and I definitely will be reading both of your books, hopefully come Christmas. I know I've definitely got Kim's books on my Kindle. I just need to get yours, Johanna's. And then I'm set. I just need time to read. Time to read and to review. But is there anything else you'd like to discuss or talk about or let viewers and readers know about women, whether it's in the Viking history or the mythology, or even kind of what brought you to we understand that Johanna, you wrote about Queen Aeson because she's such a remarkable woman and so very little is known about her and she needs more of a high profile, which is truly justified. But what brought you to writing about your female protagonist, Kim, if you don't mind me asking?
I was more drawn to, well, one, I was interested in that concept of a peace weaver, of a woman who was married for peace. And so I did that, but I was also, I wanted to explore like another side of these Viking warriors. So my male main character like loves his family, loves his children and stuff. So he can compartmentalize his life. Mm-hmm. So he can be a vicious warrior on one hand and like be a loving father on the other. Anyway, I just kind of wanted like another view of that too, of masculinity. And yeah, I was just really fascinated with the idea of the peace weaver and the peacemaker and how that would work and the ties between family and what would make somebody choose to do that, those kinds of things.
Mm. Very interesting. Well, I look forward to reading it once I get hold of my Kindle and sit down and can read. Now, in terms of your own podcast, Shield Maiden, Women of the Norse World, what interesting topics have you got coming up that listeners and readers of this episode may look forward to when they click over and join your podcast?
So let's see, this is November. In December,
it's Octavia, right?
It's Octavia Randolph, the author Octavia Randolph she wrote the Circle of Caradwyn.
Not heard series. Of her before.
And that's up to 12 books, I believe. That's
wow. Mm-hmm.
And we just recently, in October, we had an interview with the archaeologist Marianne Moen, and we had a really interesting discussion about gender archaeology, and we even had a little bit about the Victorians and
and how they influenced and a how lot they influenced, of archaeology.
Yeah. So, yeah,
and also just how so many things have over the centuries have been interpreted to leave women out. And now archaeology is starting to put women back in the picture and they're finding ways to do that. So that made it very, very interesting.
That was the October 2024 episode. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we have Nancy Marie Brown coming, right?
Yep.
Oh, fighting. I'm halfway through her book.
I've read almost all her books. I found out there's one book of hers I haven't read yet. The first one about the horse. But otherwise, I've read all her books, so very interesting.
I've read several of them, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, would you mind just showcasing her wonderful book, Johanna? Because mine's hidden a room away, but I know you've got
it. Definitely my favorite one right here, The Real Valkyrie. And but she started out, what really caught my interest was The Far Traveler, which is about another real woman, Gudrid, who also sailed to Greenland, and she sailed to America along with Freydis. And we've done some episodes on her too. So that was one of her earlier books. That's the first book I read of hers. And then I
me too.
All her other books, because she's a very good writer as well. Very interesting.
That's one thing I've liked about her book, The Real Valkyrie, The Secret History of Shield Maidens and Warrior Women. It's got a nice narrative aspect to it, which helps those who aren't used to reading nonfiction kind of get immersed, and then they see the facts behind what they're seeing. It's what drew me really well into Queen Emma and the Vikings by Harriet O'Brien about Emma of Normandy. That kind of painted a beautiful picture of kind of like a teenage girl on a boat sailing to England to marry a man she never met who's older than her dad. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's so tragic. And yet it happened. And yet she did remarkably well out of it. I'll put the link and the title to any of the books that you'd like to recommend. And of course, I will definitely say, viewers and listeners, go check out these ladies' wonderful podcasts, Chill Maiden, Women of the North World. Start from episode one, go all the way to the latest one. They cover so many topics. I don't know how you guys find the time to research and then record it all. I just about find time to squeeze in my little rants of fandom and craziness. And I'm so glad that you both wanted and are happy to be part of my joyride on YouTube of just talking about Norse stuff. Because I have no expertise, I'm just a crazy consumer, basically.
Well, it was fun. Thank you for having us.
It was great. Yes, thank you.
It's been really wonderful talking to you both. So thank you both again. Check out their podcast, everyone. The books will be down in the links below. And hopefully we will see you again for episode 10, which is set to record in December. And I have an interesting and exciting fantasy author joining called Thilde Holder Colt. She wrote the Hanged God trilogy, and the first one is called Northern Wrath. It's with a bit of history, but definitely a big dose of what I call Norse fantasy, which is mythology and magic and everything in between. And she's got some interesting female characters going on, including giants as well as shield maidens, because she allows all the women in her universe to be equal warriors as long as the men. That's to come. Hopefully it'll debut in December. So I do hope, dear viewers and listeners, you will join me again then for another episode of Valhalla Conversations. Please hit subscribe below. Thank you very much.